the Jeunesse Canadienne-Française, NAB Canada, and many other groups, including the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
To the Greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
My name is Anel Schielein. I was a foreign affairs officer at the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, and I resigned over the administration's policy towards Israel and Palestine. I hadn't planned to resign publicly, but when I started to tell colleagues that I was going to resign, so many people asked me if I could speak up, not only for myself, but for them.
Another State Department official publicly resigns in protest over the Biden administration's support for Israel's assault on Gaza. She'll join us from Washington, D.C. Then, despite an imminent famine, Israel informs the United Nations it'll cut off all UNRWA convoys to the north of Gaza. And President Biden signs a spending bill that strips funding to the UN Refugee Agency for the next year. We'll go to Jordan to speak with UNRWA spokesperson Tamara Al-Rifai. But first, a doctor who spent 2 weeks volunteering and living at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in central Gaza, Dr. Tanya Al-Haj, just left Gaza yesterday. She'll join us from Amman as well. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Al Jazeera has released a video showing Israeli soldiers fatally shooting two unarmed Palestinians near Gaza City, then burying their bodies with a bulldozer. One of the men can be seen waving a piece of white fabric before they shoot him dead. Indiscriminate Israeli attacks continued throughout the Gaza Strip Wednesday. Musa Dahir lost his parents in an Israeli airstrike on Rafah.
I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. I can't make sense of what happened. My parents, my father with his displaced friends who came from Gaza near the industrial area and were staying with him. They were all together when suddenly they were all gone like dust. They fled from one death and came to another. If the Security Council issues another resolution, they will hit more. For God's sake, do not pass more resolutions. That's enough. Every time they pass a resolution, they hit us more. We're all dying, my parents last night. We will be tomorrow. Others will follow. We're all on the way to death.
The Israeli raid and siege on Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City is now in its 10th day. The rights group Euromed Human Rights Monitor says at least 13 children have been killed by Israeli forces in and near Al-Shifa since the raid started. Meanwhile, local media is reporting Palestinian journalist Mohammed Abu Sakhil was shot and killed at Al-Shifa Hospital. In related news, the Palestine Red Crescent says Israel recently released seven of its members who were detained on the raid on Al-Amal Hospital in February. The health workers, who included the director of ambulance and emergency services in Gaza, spent 47 days in prison. Eight other Red Crescent staffers are still being held. This comes as UNRWA said 171 of its workers have now been killed in Gaza. The death toll there since October 7th has now topped 32,500, including 14,000 children. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed at least four Palestinians Wednesday. Three of them were killed in an overnight air raid.
I started screaming and my nephew was with me. I was calling for an ambulance or a car and calling on the people to come and help us to move bodies from the ground. People came to help because the ambulance was late because the checkpoint was closed. We carried Hamza and he was still breathing, but when we reached the ambulance, he died.
The Palestinian Health Ministry says at least 450 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank since October 7th. Another 4,700 have been wounded. Over 7,300 have been detained. Also in the occupied West Bank, the Israeli human rights group Looking the Occupation in the Eye said a shooting attack on a highway near the town of Al-Auja injured two of its activists. They were reportedly on their way to help Palestinian shepherds. A 13-year-old Israeli boy was also injured. Here in the U.S., another State Department official has publicly resigned over the Biden administration's support for Israel. Anel Shelein was a foreign affairs officer in the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights and Labor, who focused on promoting human rights in the Middle East and North Africa. In a piece for CNN, she writes, quote, "Whatever credibility the United States had as an advocate for human rights has almost entirely vanished since the war began." Anel Shelein will be joining us later in the broadcast. The president of the Center for American Progress, Patrick Gaspard, who is also a longtime Democratic insider and former U.S. ambassador to South Africa, blasted the Biden administration's defense of Israel's actions in Gaza. Gaspard's comments came after State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller told reporters this week the U.S. believes Israel is complying with international law. Gaspard said Miller's statement is, quote, "a gross disregard of overwhelming evidence and a dangerous precedent in the conduct of U.S. foreign policy." Meanwhile, the White House says it's working with Israel to reschedule a date for a D.C. visit by an Israeli delegation to discuss the planned invasion of Rafah. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had previously canceled the meeting after the U.S. refused to veto a U.N. Security Council ceasefire resolution. Elsewhere, Ireland says it'll intervene in South Africa's genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. The Irish Foreign Minister, Michael Martin, said Israel's actions in Gaza constitute a, quote, "blatant violation of international humanitarian law on a mass scale." In Jordan, police continue to crack down on thousands of protesters who've been demonstrating near the Israeli embassy in Amman for 3 days. Protesters could be heard chanting "betrayal" as they call on Jordan to cancel its deals with Israel.
Our message has been a message of the Jordanian popular movement since the beginning of October 7th and before that. We are asking the Jordanian government to cancel the Wadi Araba peace treaty with Israel and all its annexes that we believe harm Jordanian national interests. This requires us to stand with the choices of the Palestinian people who are facing an aggression by the Zionist entity, the American administration, and the European West.
In Baltimore, rescue workers recovered the bodies of two victims of the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse. The men were identified as 35-year-old Alejandro Hernandez Fuentes, originally from Mexico, and 26-year-old Dorlian Roniel Castillo Cabrera from Guatemala. Another four workers are still missing and presumed dead in the river. All six victims were immigrant overnight construction workers. The National Transportation Safety Board said the investigation into the cargo ship's collision with the bridge could take 1 to 2 years to complete. President Biden has vowed to direct federal funds to pay for the entire cost of the bridge's reconstruction. In Alabama, a Democrat has flipped a seat in the state legislature after running on abortion rights and preserving access to IVF, in vitro fertilization, in what Democrats hope is a bellwether ahead of November. Marilyn Land said of her victory, quote, "Alabama women and families sent a clear message that will be heard in Montgomery and across the nation. Our legislature must repeal Alabama's no-exceptions abortion ban, fully restore access to IVF, and protect the right to contraception," she said. Voting rights advocates in Pennsylvania are expressing alarm after a federal appeals court ruled undated mail-in ballots should not be counted even if they arrive on time. The ACLU said this could result in thousands of Pennsylvania voters losing their votes. The Republican National Committee praised the ruling. Meanwhile, Montana, the state Supreme Court, has struck down four Republican laws aimed at restricting the vote, including one which would have largely ended same-day voter registration. The three white men who chased down and killed Ahmaud Arbery in 2020, asked a federal appeals court Wednesday to toss out their hate crimes convictions. The three convicted murderers say prosecutors did not prove they targeted Arbery, who they shot and killed while he was out for a jog because he was black. During the trial of William Bryan and father and son Greg and Travis McMichael, prosecutors shared dozens of racist text messages and social media posts from the men in the months and years before the murder of 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery. Ahmaud's father, Marcus Arbery, responded to the news Wednesday.
The evidence just too strong against old man. I don't care what them lawyers said. Evidence was just too strong. And me and my family, we just had to be strong to just sit back. We know everything all right. Because I'm going to tell you, the evidence was just too strong against those three men.
Donald Trump lashed out at New York Judge Juan Merchan and the judge's daughter just hours after the judge imposed a gag order on Trump ahead of his criminal hush money trial next month. On his Truth Social platform, Trump called Judge Merchan a hater and accused him of being biased and conflicted. In response to the partial gag order, Trump claimed Merchan was, quote, wrongfully attempting to deprive me of my First Amendment right to speak out against the weaponization of law enforcement, unquote. The gag order does not technically shield Merchan from public statements by Trump. Former Connecticut senator and vice presidential candidate Joe Lieberman has died at the age of 82 after a fall. Lieberman was a leading backer of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. He also helped kill the public option in the Affordable Care Act and fought efforts to expand Medicare eligibility. In 2000, he became the first Jewish vice presidential nominee on a major party ticket when he ran as Al Gore's running mate. In 2008, he endorsed Republican Senator John McCain for president over Barack Obama. In his memoir, McCain said he was sorry he didn't choose Lieberman as his vice presidential running mate over Sarah Palin. The Phoenix City Council has approved a new ordinance to protect many workers from extreme heat. Phoenix is the hottest city in the country. Contractors working with the city will be required to provide cooling breaks, cold water, and air conditioning. Meanwhile, in Florida, the Republican-led state legislature recently passed a bill barring municipalities in Florida from adopting any local measures to protect workers from extreme heat. In Argentina, a court has convicted 11 former officials of crimes against humanity for committing atrocities against over 600 people during the military dictatorship that ruled Argentina from 1976 to 83. The victims included transgender women, high school students, prisoners who gave birth in captivity and whose babies were taken from them. The court ruled the former military, police, and government officials were involved in forced disappearances, torture, rape, and murder at secret torture centers on the outskirts of Buenos Aires. On Sunday, thousands of Argentines gathered in Buenos Aires to remember the victims of the military dictatorship.
Today, some families here in Argentina are still searching for their children. The idea is that every March 24th, we should remember that date so we don't repeat those mistakes. A people that has a memory does not repeat those mistakes.
This all comes as Argentina's new far-right president, Javier Milei, faces renewed criticism for downplaying dictatorship-era atrocities. In Indonesia, 13 soldiers have been arrested after video emerged showing them torturing a man at a military outpost in West Papua. The Indonesian military also issued a rare apology for the incident. According to Amnesty International, the man who was tortured later died. In Russia, the death toll from last week's concert hall attack has risen to 143. Around 80 people remain hospitalized after surviving the worst terror attack in Moscow in decades. The arrest of four Tajik nationals has sparked an increase in attacks on Central Asian migrants in Moscow and other cities. The embassy of Tajikistan in Russia has warned its citizens to stay home if possible. And UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for reparations for the transatlantic slave trade to, quote, help overcome generations of exclusion and discrimination. Guterres made the statement on the UN International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
And Nermeen, belated happy birthday.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you. Nearly 6 months into Israel's assault on Gaza, the health sector has been completely decimated. Before October 7th, Gaza had 36 hospitals. Nearly 6 months later, only two are minimally functional and 10 are partially functional, according to the United Nations. The rest have shut down completely after either being shelled, besieged and raided by Israeli troops, or running out of fuel and medicine. The death toll from the Israeli assault has topped 32,500, including over 14,000 children, with nearly 75,000 wounded. The entire population of Gaza is facing high or catastrophic levels of acute food insecurity, and famine is imminent in the north. At least 27 people, mostly children, have died of malnutrition and dehydration.
In Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, the largest hospital in Gaza, an Israeli raid is continuing for the 10th day. Israeli forces there have killed at least 200 people and detained over 400. Meanwhile, the UN reports that as of Tuesday, Al-Amal Hospital in Khan Yunis has ceased functioning. That leaves the remaining hospitals in Gaza that are able to partially function completely overwhelmed. One of those is the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. Our next guest just spent 2 weeks volunteering at and living there with a team of international doctors. Dr. Tanya Hash-Hassan is a pediatric intensive care physician who works with Doctors Without Borders. She's co-founder of the social media account Gaza Medic Voices, which shares firsthand accounts from healthcare professionals in Gaza. She just left Gaza yesterday. She's joining us now from Amman, Jordan. Tanya, welcome back to Democracy Now! I know you're absolutely exhausted. Can you just share your experiences of the last 2 weeks, what you feel it's most important for people around the world to understand?
Yeah, certainly. Thank you. Just to clarify, I was in Gaza with a charity called Medical Aid for Palestinians UK, MAP UK. It's really difficult to describe in words the horrors that we saw in our 2 weeks there. You know, you watch the news, you have some idea of what you're going to see, but experiencing in real time entire family structures collapsing, entire families being wiped off the civil registry, having to tell a father or a mother that their entire family, their lifelong partner and all of their children have just been killed and you weren't able to resuscitate them is something that was very difficult to experience and something that I hope I never have to experience again. And frankly, it's something that I just feel ashamed that we're still talking about, 7 months into this. It just is such a stark representation of our failure, of our failure as humanity, that this is not a humanitarian crisis. This is the worst of what humanity is capable of, and it's entirely all man-made. And when you witness it firsthand, it's an unbearable injustice.
Well, Dr. Tanya Hash-Hassan, thank you for that account. If you could also talk about some of the nurses with whom you worked. For our television viewers, you've seen some of the images that Tanya sent to us. And if you could speak specifically about a nurse whose name you cannot reveal for security reasons, who holds in his hand an infant, which we'll show now on screen. If you could talk about the story of what happened with this nurse and the child in his hands.
Yeah, certainly. I think this photo is very representative of the utter exhaustion and yet ongoing determination of the healthcare staff there. Healthcare workers in general have been targeted since day one, as have health facilities. Al-Aqsa Hospital is a smaller hospital in the scheme of Gazan hospitals. The largest two hospitals are first Al-Shifa Hospital and then Al-Nasser Hospital. And as you mentioned in your introduction, both of them have been directly besieged. They've been targeted, bombed, deprived of resources. Their healthcare staff have been forced to flee. Many of the healthcare workers are arrested. They describe changing out of their scrubs or being told by civilians to change out of their scrubs when they're fleeing. We've had civilians give healthcare workers their own clothes so that they're not seen wearing scrubs, because we know that healthcare workers have been systematically targeted in this particular war. So I think I wanted to start by saying healthcare workers are under an enormous amount of pressure. They're directly targeted. These healthcare workers evacuate, travel a very long way, and then ultimately are back at work, work extremely hard, do all that they can to keep patients alive. And in this particular photo, this particular nurse, one of the most hardworking nurses that I worked with, had come to the end of a 24-hour shift, had tried very hard to resuscitate this infant, and unfortunately was unable to, and then just passed out of exhaustion onto the stretcher in front of him, carrying the now dead child. A lot of times we can't even tell the parents that their child has been killed, because there are no parents to be found. And that's unfortunately a very common occurrence. In many of the other photos that you'll see in front of you, I'm not sure which photos, Democracy Now, you're sharing. I can't see them on my end. But you can see the carnage, the very difficult circumstances under which the emergency room department is trying to operate. A lot of the senior doctors have fled. Junior doctors who are straight out of medical school are on call overnight, receiving mass casualties with stories I can share with you, but stories that are very difficult and unbearable to experience, let alone talk about. But I'm happy to share more.
Can you talk about where you stayed, if you slept where you slept?
Yeah, we slept in a room in the hospital. They had the female healthcare workers in one room on mats, and the male healthcare workers in another room. And we basically worked day and night. We had a surgical team with us that operated through most of the night, just so that we can get through the very large backload of cases. This is a very small hospital that has a capacity of about 200 patients and is running with over 700 patients at the moment. And then there are thousands of internally displaced people there as well. So they have a backlog of patients that require medical attention, that require surgical procedures to prevent their wounds from becoming infected, to stabilize fractures, and unfortunately, they don't have the surgical space or workforce to get those cases done. So our team was just trying to offload some of that work. The teams there are also just utterly exhausted. I mean, they've been doing this for over 170 days. We did it for 2 weeks and we're exhausted. I cannot begin to fathom what it feels like for them.
And Dr. Tania Haj Hassan, if you could, you mentioned in the image that you sent us and that we showed of the child in the nurse's hands, you said that there were no parents or family members to whom you could convey the information of what happened to this child. The last time we had you on, you spoke about this new acronym, Wounded Child, No Surviving Family. Obviously, this child was among those. If you could talk about the number of children who were coming in either on their own or who were left on their own.
Yeah, certainly. In fact, there are a number of them that are living in the hospital at the moment and being cared for by strangers or relatives. Often what happens is we'll receive children, dead or still alive. We'll attempt to resuscitate them, and we'll start asking around, does anybody know if there's family for this child in the hospital that have come in with the same mass casualty? And we'll have a distant relative look at us and say, like, they've unfortunately been martyred or they've been killed. And so it was a very common occurrence to have a child that we were resuscitating and not know if any of their family were alive, or be told that their family had been killed, or be told that that other woman that we're resuscitating simultaneously on the floor is the child's mother. I remember one incident where we received a young boy who the side of his face had been blown off, and we were providing care for him while providing care for his sister in the adjacent bed. His sister had 96% of her body burned. Their parents and all of their other siblings had been killed in the same attack. And he kept asking for his family, and he had a distant cousin who was at his bedside who kept saying, they're fine, they're injured, they're going to be fine. And he kept saying, where's my sister? He could see the patient next to him. He just couldn't recognize her because she was so badly burned, but that was his sister. She unfortunately died despite our efforts. 96% body surface area burn is essentially a death sentence, particularly under those resource circumstances. She died a couple days later in the intensive care unit, and he is still in the hospital receiving reconstructive surgery for his neck and face. But as of the moment I left, his distant relatives hadn't had the heart to tell him that they had all died. He was suspecting it, so when I would pass by to check on him, he would say, I have a feeling my family has been martyred. I wish I had been martyred too. So I think he knows. But it's utterly unbearable. There's another child that has an external fixator, so rods in his leg after some complex fractures, that, you know, lives in the hospital at the moment for ongoing care and is cared for by strangers because he doesn't have any relatives in the hospital. And his car was bombed as they were trying to flee, and his family was killed, but he still thinks his family is in the north. Other children know that their family has been killed and are being cared for by extended relatives. Fortunately, their faith is strong, and they are able to rationalize in whatever way this is. You're able to rationalize these atrocities. I find them very difficult, if not impossible, to rationalize. This is an utter and complete failure of humanity. And to be frank, I feel ashamed to be an American citizen. I feel ashamed to be part of a society that has allowed this to continue. And I'm very much hoping and looking forward to the moment where we decide to take a courageous stance and put an end to this massacre.
Why did you go back, Dr. Tania Hash Hassan? You have been there a number of times.
So I had been there over the last 10 years to teach. This is an area that's been besieged for 16 years. And you have healthcare providers that are working under unimaginable circumstances before October 2023. And I think witnessing what was happening from a distance thereafter, witnessing the injustice, witnessing the immense pressure under which our colleagues were working, I found it unbearable not to be there with them. And in fact, I probably felt most at ease in the last, since October, the moment I arrived in Gaza and knew that I could now actually join them in solidarity in providing care for their patients, because they're doing exactly what we signed up to do in our Hippocratic Oath. And they're doing it with a level of commitment and determination that is incomprehensible. It is so impressive, and yet being attacked and directly targeted. And I think most healthcare workers that I know that are aware of what's happening feel the same way I do and cannot wait to be there in person to provide solidarity, or are providing that solidarity in different ways from a distance.
And And as you were treating, Dr. Haj Hassan, as you were treating children, people with such horrific injuries, if you could talk about the kind of equipment you had to work with. There are reports of aid trucks being denied entry because there were basic medical supplies, scalpels, scissors. Explain what doctors there have to work with as they confront these absolutely unimaginable injuries.
So there's certainly a shortage of a lot of things we need to work. And I think at a very basic level, there's just shortage of space. So you can imagine when we resuscitate a single patient that arrives into an emergency department, we put them in a resuscitation bed in a bay surrounded by equipment. That is not at all what's happening in these hospitals. When we receive a mass casualty, the most critical cases get moved into this red area. There are three beds in the red area, and then the rest we resuscitate on the floor in the red area or the yellow zone. And so we'll have amputations that we do on the floor of the yellow zone of an emergency department. And